Okay, so we are going to go ahead and get started. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us today. If you are here on this webinar, then you're here to see the Fulbright Scholar in Residence Program's application walkthrough. So we've held a series of webinars geared towards different demographics and universities, institutions, and now we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of the application today. So we're really excited. So my name is Kaylee Smasniak. I'm a placement advisor here at IIE, and I work with researchers and scholars and students. And then I'm also joined by my colleague, Tamman. Tamman, if you wanted to introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. My name is Tamman Nicholson. I'm a regional teams analyst here at IIE.
And then we also have David Levin on the line. David, if you wanted to introduce yourself, too.
Sure. David Levin. I'm with the Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs of the State Department.
All right. So today we have the presentation overview for you here. I'm just going to pass it on over to Tamman. He'll be talking through what we'll be going over today and some of the background of the program itself.
Great. Thank you, Kaylee. So today we're going to provide an overview of the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program, including some of the programmatic insights from the State Department and trends in the program. We'll talk a little bit about the number of grants that are awarded and some overall insights into your application. If you've attended one of the previous spring webinars, the first portion of this will probably be a little bit familiar, but afterwards we're going to segue into the application components and the available tools. Afterwards we'll wrap up with some other opportunities through the Fulbright program and then a Q&A. If you have any questions about the program throughout our webinar, just type it in the chat box and we'll answer some of the questions towards the end of the webinar. All right, so let's get started. So the Fulbright program was established in 1946. We're entering our 72nd year this year. The goal of the program is to send U.S. academics and professionals overseas and to bring scholars and professionals from abroad to the United States. It's sponsored by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Education and Cultural Affairs, and it's administered by the Institute of International Education. This is a prestigious academic exchange program, and the primary purpose is to develop diplomacy it's a diplomacy initiative within the Department of State, and it's designed to expand and strengthen relationships between the people of the U.S. and citizens across the world. Looking at this slide, some of the previous Fulbright grantees that we've featured is the first Fulbright grantee to go to Burma in 1960. And then also one of our Fulbright Arctic scholars from 2014. And I think this range of fields and locations is probably a pretty good symbol of the Scholar in Residence program in general, with the amount of fields of study and institutions that can be served through the SIR program. So segueing into the Scholar in Residence program, this is a wonderful opportunity for scholars and faculty members from overseas to join campuses that might not have the opportunity to host a scholar or have a strong international presence. We focus a lot on community colleges, rural colleges, minority-serving institutions. This application is institutionally driven, and it helps internationalize your campus and develop exchange courses and international opportunities moving forward. The scholars primarily teach undergraduate academic courses for either a semester or a full academic year, but they also provide a cross-cultural perspective onto your campus. So they're doing more than just teaching in the classroom. They're involved with groups on campus, with cultural fairs, some activities within the community. So they're doing more than just being stuck in a research lab or within a classroom for their duration. What really sets this program apart is the fact that the institutions drive the process. It's institutionally driven, as we said, which means that when your campus applies for an SIR, you envision what that semester or what that academic year is going to look like, and then if there is a scholar in mind, we're able to help that scholar and bring them to your campus, or if need be, we can recruit a scholar that fits into what your model is for your SIR program. The scholars teach full course loads, and they should be also engaging with campus culture, like I mentioned before. So these scholars are typically more visible than some of the other Fulbright scholars that might come from overseas. With that, I'm going to pass it over to David to talk a little bit about the program benefits from the State Department's perspective.
Sure. Thanks, Tamman. So we think this program is unique, as Tammy said, because it's institutionally driven. So you're basically, as part of your proposal, in a sense, you're crafting the blueprint as to what you would like a scholar to do. What will they specifically be teaching on campus in terms of courses? How will they be engaged with the campus beyond those particular courses they're teaching? And then how will they engage with your community beyond campus itself? So the whole objective of all of this is increasing organization for you as an institution. So it meets the Fulbright objective, which provides mutual understanding for Americans and citizens from other countries, but it's unique with this aspect of Fulbright because it's an activity that's taking place across campus, and you have determined how your scholar really will affect your entire campus and your entire community. So it's a broader kind of Fulbright than the individual Fulbrighter who comes and does their own research, let's say, whether it's American going overseas or someone coming from overseas to the United States, whether it's research, whether it's a student kind of grant. These are more institutional-driven, institutionally benefits you as an institution. I think it's unique from that perspective. Also, because of the fact with this program, we're reaching out to institutions that have had less experience hosting scholars, have perhaps less experience doing international kinds of things on campus, and or, in fact, are serving minority audiences. So this program is unique because of the fact that we prioritized the program for, as Cameron was talking about, community colleges, minority-serving institutions, small liberal arts colleges, and rural colleges and universities.
Thanks, David. And I think you segued perfectly to our next slide, the institutions that are served by the SIR program. So the list you see here are institutions that we target for this program, but they're not the full range of institutions that could be served by an SIR. So if you're not an administrator at an HBCU or a small liberal arts college, what we would suggest is that you partner with another local institution in the area. So we do target institutions that have infrequently or even never hosted a visiting scholar, but that doesn't mean that if you have hosted a scholar in the past that you're automatically excluded. We would just ask you to partner with some institutions that might fit into this demographic, whether they're HSIs or community colleges or one of the college options that you see here. And then just to give a breakdown of the institutions that are typically served by the SIR, this is our breakdown of SIR grants from 2010 to 2016. Most of the institutions fall into minority-serving institutions, small liberal arts colleges, community colleges, and then we have a chunk for other as well. So that means that even larger research institutions or institutions that don't fall within the priority institution breakdown, they've still applied to the SIR program and have been granted an SIR grant as well. David, do you want to highlight any trends that you've seen among some of these institution types?
Yeah, I think it's varied a little bit. I think in terms of community colleges, we've seen kind of a steady numbers throughout the years. I think with MSIs, HBCUs have been fairly steady. We've seen an increase, I think, in terms of Hispanic-serving institutions. We've seen an increase, I think, in terms of Asian American Pacific Islander-serving institutions. So some of the MSI groupings clearly are increasing. Rural is a new category for us, so we haven't measured it beyond a year ago, but I suspect that area, that's a category that will increase. It's one of the large colleges, I think, have also done pretty well consistently. So I think overall it's been about 75% of the institutions receiving grants in a given year have been from the targeted institutions.
All right, great. Thank you so much to both Tammy and David for those insights into the background. And I think that now we're actually going to jump in and actually walk through the application online here. So for any of you who may have started an application or who are thinking of starting an application, We want to try to answer all of the questions that you might have about what the logistics and what the click-by-click will look like for you when you're going through this process. So you'll see in the webinar, I guess just a quick note for everyone that all of this will be uploaded to our website after just a couple of days. So you'll get an email saying that this whole webinar is accessible on the website now, and you'll actually be able to go through and click in through all of these hyperlinks. So that's really helpful for you if you don't, if you're not writing everything down right now or just even running through it right now with me. So let's just hop on to CIAS.org here. And I actually do encourage you to be clicking along with me if you can, just because once you're doing it yourself, I know it can get a little bit easier to navigate. So this is just the main page here. And then we're going to go over to Programs, and then you are a U.S. institution. It's an institution-driven application. And then this is the Scholar in Residence Program. Just a few pieces about this page. It's a lot of the information that we were just talking about, that Tamin and David were talking about. But if you scroll down here, you'll actually be able to see all of the past webinars that we've hosted this year and this cycle, and any future webinars. So right now we're in this May 14th one. And then you'll see that as we're approaching that application deadline of October 15th, we'll be having a few last calls, we're calling them. And they're kind of like office hours where you can log in, ask questions yourself to program staff here at IIE, Department of State, and also just hear what other people are asking. So definitely keep an eye out for those. Definitely recommend doing that. And then one final piece I wanted to mention before we jump in is that, yes, the application deadline is October 15th, but we also do offer a draft proposal deadline of October 1st. So if, as you're watching me walk through all of this today, you find that you have some questions or ideas and you want to know if it makes sense or if you think that it's feasible within the spectrum of the program, then you can reach out to us at that sir@iie.org email address, which you'll also see on the PowerPoint later, and we'll be able to talk with you through any questions that you have. But definitely use that October 1st draft deadline to talk through any concerns or questions. The earlier the better, before that October 15th final deadline. So, okay, for today, we're going to be focusing on this application tab here. And bear with me because my mouse is a little tricky today. It's moving slower than my hand, so here we go. So you'll see on this first page here that there's the application guidelines. This is a wonderful, wonderful resource for everyone. It gives feedback and advice and insights into what we're looking for in each and every piece of this application. So click on that, have it open as you're going through the application process, and it's super helpful. But for now, let's just click on the Embark application here. So it is already logging me in, but if you hadn't already logged in, when you click this, it will have you either use a pre-existing username and password, and you would sign in that way. You can also register in order to create a new application. And then another option, actually, is that you can log in using Facebook if you feel the need to do that, too. But this is the page, this is kind of your main dashboard where you'll be seeing any past applications or current applications that you are working on. So here we have, these are past cycles that I had an application open for. And then this one here you'll see is my Fulbright Scholar in Residence Program 2019-2020 application. So that is what we will be working on. And I know that it doesn't say click here or anything necessarily, so I will just say if you hover over your name and you click it, then it will take you immediately into the application that you have already begun or that you have just started. Okay. So just jumping right in, and Tamin and David, feel free to jump in at any time if you have anything to add. but as soon as you click start on that application, you'll see some preliminary questions. So this just wants to make sure that the correct people are applying to the correct program, just because we know that there are quite a few Fulbright programs under the Fulbright umbrella. So again, this is the Scholar in Residence program, and it's U.S. institutions applying to host a scholar in residence. So I am saying, yes, I am applying on behalf of an institute of higher education. I'm putting my name in here. And then let's just say that IIE is an institute of higher education right here. Make sure that you are clicking Save and Next all throughout, or else you'll be seeing some tricky things happening. So I just want to make sure that you are clicking Save all the way through your application. And that said, just a note, you don't have to be completing this application all in one sit down or go around, so you can just save and exit at any time. Okay. So when we clicked Save and Next last time, it took us over to those application guidelines again, so the ones that I had just mentioned, that resource. So you can also access them here. But we'll just click Save and Next for now. Okay. So now you'll be seeing that there are kind of two main sections of the application. There's the institutional information, which we'll be talking about here, kind of these first two sections, and those consist of text boxes and drop-downs. I'll go through them in detail in a moment. And then a little bit later, we'll be getting into uploads. So these sections here are where you're actually crafting your proposal and your institutional profile essay and uploading them directly into the application. So just to kind of set the groundwork for us here. So we're starting in this first section, the institutional information. So here you are filling in the name of your institution, city, state. You'll see that sometimes you're not typing it in and there are drop-downs, so just make sure that you're filtering through all of your options correctly here. And then any item that has an asterisk associated with it means that it's required before you can click submit at the end of the day. Okay, so then as Cameron had mentioned earlier, if you are applying along with another U.S. institution, so if, for example, you are you don't necessarily fall in those categories that the community college or the minority-serving institutions, and if you are doing a joint proposal, then you would click Yes here. And this will speak to other sections of the application. So just make sure, again, because it has that asterisk, make sure that you're clicking if you are a joint proposal or not. Let's just say no for now. And then you can also select here if your institution falls under one of those designations that we discussed. It is really important that you mark it here, if at all possible, just because when we're conducting our application review and later when the review committee is convening, we use this information to guide our discussions also. Okay. And all of this is still associated with your institution, so next up, we have the responsible administrative official. So as it says here, this is the person who is responsible for confirming that the institution can host a potential visiting scholar. So you'll be marking that information here. And then later on, we'll be talking about where you can give a little bit more information about this administrative official. But for now, all you're doing is giving their name and contact information. Okay. So we'll scroll down here, and we would be clicking Save and Next. Okay. So this was the more institutional information, and now we're getting into the proposed program. So again, we're working pretty far in advance. This is for a 2019 and 2020 academic year. So just, you know, make sure that you're selecting dates that fall within those year and that year, and we'll be using these dates to determine if you're asking for a semester or a full academic year for hosting a potential scholar. Okay. And then here we have, so you had already listed that one contact on campus, that administrative contact. But then we also want to see who would be the principal contact for academic arrangements. Sometimes this could also be the administrative official. So it really does work differently at each institution. So we leave it up to you. It's not really one size fits all. Sometimes we've seen an administrative official listed as a dean or a department head, or I think we've seen a president's office before. So if you're not sure who might be the correct contact for either of these, then talk to someone in your grant office if you have one, or an international student services office if you have one, and you can always check in with us as well. Okay, so you will just be putting in information, more biographical information, what department they're associated with. Because this is the faculty member, the potential contact for academic arrangements, we are also asking for the department, school, or college that the faculty member is associated with, along with their discipline. And then just some more contact information here. Okay. And then the next piece of this is we're asking about financial support. So this section, you would just be putting the value of the financial support that you might be able to provide. So I will say that we've seen this take shape in very different ways. I might pass this over to David in a moment to talk about what we've seen in the past for in-kind versus salary supplement. But I will say that for now, you are just putting in the basic values or a brief description, and then later during your actual proposal, there's a section where you'll be elaborating in on this. But David, did you want to talk for a moment about that in-kind support?
Sure. So when we talk about different kinds of financial support, we talk about cash. That's typically a salary supplement if that's feasible for your institution. Realize that that's going to be a case-by-case situation as to whether you can do that or not and how funding that might include. And then we talk about in-kind support can take shape in a whole variety of ways. We've seen everything from actual campus housing to a meal ticket in the dining hall to support for your scholar to attend conferences, support for perhaps a spouse to audit classes or to take English language lessons. Think creatively as to what kind of support you could provide, whether it's cash, whether it's in kind. As I said, we look at this case by case. This is not a make or break situation if you can or can't provide support. We encourage you if that's doable. And we want to work with you. As Kelly said, we've seen a variety of examples as to how people have creatively put together some kind of package.
Okay, great. Thanks, David. Okay, and again, this is just where you're putting in those actual values, and then later you'll be explaining. You can also enter your institution's approximate salary ranges here. And then we're getting into the scholar itself. So there are two different tracks that the application allows for. You can either name a scholar or you can ask for recruitment of a scholar. So you'll see if you name a scholar, then it changes what you're seeing in the application. So you'd actually be putting in the potential scholar's information here. And it says that you can list the scholars in order of priority. So again, you'll see if you scroll down the type of information that is requested. We do need to make sure that there's contact information there also, because if your institution is awarded funding, then we'll be using all of this information here in order to proceed. Okay, so just to give you an idea of what all of this looks like. And then you'll also want to give a brief outline as to why that particular scholar best fits what you're proposing. And then just one other item that isn't necessarily biographical is this English proficiency. So we just want to make sure that the potential scholar has the required English skills to teach a topic on campus. But if we go back up here, and if you click No, then instead, you'd be able to list up to two countries within one geographic region. So we could do, let's say, Azerbaijan, and my mouse again, and Belarus. Okay. And just a note, if you're not sure if a certain country is acceptable or if we're able to work with certain countries, then there is a list on the website here. So you'll be able to see that. And if you're still not sure, then again, just feel free to reach out to us at that sir@iie.org website. And then we ask that the institution indicates if you have ever hosted a visiting scholar before. So as we had said, this application is geared towards or targeted at institutions that don't frequently get to host visiting scholars, but we certainly have worked in the past with scholar and residence hosts that have been awarded this grant in the past or have hosted visiting scholars in the past. So here, you would just be able to write what year the previous visit happened, what country the scholar came from, and then what discipline. If you're not sure if your institution has hosted a scholar before, then from this application page, you can actually scroll down here, and there's a list of institutions. So broken down by year back to 2007. So you can just click open one and say, okay, this host has hosted a scholar from this country. So make sure that you're indicating that here. Okay, and then we also do ask that you include a proposal summary. So this has a 700 character limit right here. And this is very important because you should use this section to just give a brief synopsis of what your application is all about and what your proposal is all about, because especially during the review, when the review committee is convening, they use this in order to also guide their discussions and to gain more insight into the highlights of what you're proposing. So what we recommend you use this section for. Okay. So now we are jumping into those upload sections that I had mentioned. Okay. So this is really the essence of the application, whereas before it was just those text boxes and drop downs. This is where we're hearing more about your institution and more about what you're proposing. So first we have this institutional profile. This is 4 to 5 pages long, or it could be 7 to 8 if you're doing one of the joint proposals. We do say keep in mind that reviewers may or may not know your institution or know what you're all about. So using this whole institutional profile section to really give a broad idea of your goals and what your institution is all about is key in this section. Okay. So then there are quite a few pieces listed here that can appear in the institutional profile section. So I know that this is quite a bit of information. So what we often recommend is that you take your 4 to 5 or your 7 to 8 pages and just break it down by these individual sections. So you could be slotting in some information under the mission and vision, values of your institution, along with what you currently have in your scope of your academic offerings. You could also be talking about where you have a need within your academic offerings that a scholar in residence could fill. You'll also be describing any experience that you've had in the past with hosting visiting scholars so that, again, we can see what you've done in the past and where that potential scholar could fit in. So you'll be hearing me say this multiple times, so really just every section of this application serves to just strengthen your larger proposal. So just use all of these pieces to talk about why your institution, why a scholar in residence at your institution. And then also in this section, you'll be discussing the short and long-term goals and objectives. So just what you're hoping to achieve or gain, more generally speaking, through internationalizing your campus and efforts. Okay, so in order to actually upload that, with all of these remaining sections here, as I had mentioned, those are the uploads. You click Upload File, and then let's just pick a file here, Open. And then it tells you what your valid formats are. And then it will tell you that it has been successful. You can also delete it. Okay. And then, David, did you have anything you wanted to mention about this first upload section?
No, I think I just sort of would reiterate the point you made about the pieces, in a sense, fitting together. And I think that proposals that are probably not as successful as others are ones that are not necessarily giving attention to all the pieces. We've designed this in a way that we think the pieces should fit together and really do a good job of guiding you in terms of the kinds of information we'd like to learn from you about your institution and the scholar you're looking for and the kinds of things they would do and how this fits your objectives and so on and so forth.
Great. One thing I'd like to add as well, the institutional profile is typically what we would be sending to U.S. embassies or Fulbright commissions overseas if we're recruiting a scholar on behalf of your institution. So this really is a great way of helping to tell your story to potential scholars if you don't have someone already in mind, because they might not be as familiar with your institution or your portion of the country or the academic offerings that you might have. So this helps us to share some of that information.
Great, thank you. Okay, so now we're jumping into whereas this was more institution focused, where you are, what you're doing. This uploaded section is where you're talking about the program that you're proposing. We do say, again, we have a link to the application guidelines here so that you can take a look at what successful applications may have included in the past. And again, this one is 8 to 9 pages if you are a single institution applying, or 12 to 13 for those joint proposals. As I had mentioned for that last one, we find that it is very helpful to just break it down, have oversight as a heading, academic program of the scholar as a heading, and so on and so forth. And this is also where, how I was mentioning in these sections up here where you were just entering that administrative official's contact information and that academic contact. In this section, you can actually break it down and talk about if the potential scholar would be working with just that one individual faculty advisor, then wonderful. So just talk about who that faculty member is, what the scholar in residence would be bringing to that specific department or that specific activity or lecture series or what have you. We have also seen in this oversight section multiple contacts listed. So we've seen Fulbright steering committees where it pulls in contacts from all across the institution. So this, because this is an uploaded section, you're able to really elaborate on what you had entered previously. So just take a look at all of these. Let us know if you have questions. Use this application guideline to help steer your conversations internally. And then I just wanted to mention also that you can talk more about the financial support that you had also entered earlier. So this is where you can elaborate. Again, this is an uploaded file. this one, as with all of the others, I should have noted this earlier, but you have to actually, you can only upload one file per section. So you'll just need to make sure that you're merging those documents and uploading them at once. And David, is there anything that you wanted to point out specifically about this second part of the narrative section?
No, I think you've done a good job. I think, again, these pieces will fit together, we hope, seamlessly. You know, this is in terms of your the offerings. Just let me say a word about the sort of parallels what Tamron was talking about. When you're describing the kinds of things your scholar would do, we realize that if you've got a scholar in mind, then you're obviously more specific about the kinds of things that scholar will do. If you're asking us to recruit for you, then obviously you're not as specific because you don't know exactly what your scholar's skills will be. But you would still provide us as much detail as you could, because that's what we're going to be using to recruit a scholar. So because the point I would make is, in addition, when we talk about recruiting a scholar, you can actually list two different countries in the same region from which you would be happy to get a scholar from. Read that closely when you finish writing that, so that you're talking in fact about both countries and not giving the preference to one over the other, perhaps, which might make it more difficult for us to recruit for you from a second country. And the reason that we in fact ask you to recruit for two countries is because if in fact one country is challenged and is not able to recruit for you, then we're hoping the second country would come through. That's the reason for the two country offerings. But as I said, think about your application when you've written that, and make sure you're addressing both countries in your application.
Yeah, that's a great point, David. Thank you. And I should also mention that whether you do have that specific scholar in mind or a niche for a scholar to be filling, you would still be talking about that potential academic program of the scholar on campus. So even if you don't have that scholar set, you could be able to say here that this department has a need for a scholar with this experience giving this lecture series, and this campus organization has a need for a mentor from this country or something along those lines. So just even if you don't have that specific scholar in mind, then you can kind of work through these sections that way. And again, if you're just not sure how that might work, then feel free to reach out to us. Okay. I will move on to the letters of recommendation section. So this is only if you are requesting a specific scholar. So if you are naming a scholar, then we'd ask that you submit a CV and two letters of recommendation. One of those letters should speak to the scholar's teaching ability, since they're coming to your campus to undertake primarily teaching. And I had already mentioned earlier the English language component, just making sure that they have all of those qualifications necessary to teach on your campus. And again, you'll just need to merge those files together before you can upload them here. Okay, jumping forward to the letters of support. So this is where you would be uploading letters of support that directly relate to your institution and what you're applying to do. There's no maximum number of letters that you can include here. You'll see a list of ideas of people that you could ask for a letter from in this section. So it's if you're arranging community outreach and activities, then you could include a letter from a Rotary Club or from a various volunteer organizations in the town or in the community or from neighboring institutions that say, this would be wonderful if we'd have access to a scholar in residence at your campus, and we'd love to host him or her for a certain event or anything like that. If you are including a letter of support here, it's not setting it in stone. This is just kind of showing that there is excitement in hosting the scholar in your campus and larger community, and that you're really ready to maximize on that scholar's time on campus. Okay, and then you're clicking Save and Next. So I had said that there was no maximum number of letters of support, but there is a minimum. You need to have at least a letter from the administrative official that you had listed in that previous section, just saying that, yes, your institution is able to host the scholar and you welcome that scholar on campus, that kind of thing. So that's in this section. And then save and next. Next we have this sample syllabi or the course outlines. So here, we'd like to see what a potential course could look like and get a sense of what it's all about. So if you're naming a specific scholar, you might already know what they'd be able to teach and kind of craft the section in a way that would outline that specific scholar's cultural perspective. But we understand that things may change. So if you're including a syllabus in this section, it's not saying that, yes, this is the exact course that will be taught and these are the exact dates. Instead, it's just saying this is the type of thing that we'd want or that we'd need, and just, again, showing that your institution is ready to be hosting that scholar on campus. And I'll also say, because there's this 10-page maximum, you don't have to necessarily like have that boilerplate language in any of your syllabi, so taking out institutional policy or anything like that. Let's see. Tamin or David, did you have anything to add about these sections? Do you want me to click backwards at all?
I think I'm fine.
Okay. Yeah, I think you covered it nicely.
Sure. Okay, then that leaves us with clicking Save and Next, and you will be doing a review. I have not been filling in all of the required fields, so I have very, very many that have this, so hopefully you don't. But you'll actually be able to navigate straight back to the page from this section. And then, after you've done all of your corrections, you will be able to submit. You'll also have the option of printing a PDF version from this portal here. So you can do that, have it for your records, make sure that you're passing it around to whomever needs to see it. But with that, I'm actually going to jump back into our PowerPoint here so that we can talk a little bit about what those next steps might look like. So once you actually move forward with your application and click that submit button by October 15th, the external review committee will be looking at a lot of these review criteria during their review. So as we've said, just make sure that all of the pieces are working together and that you're giving those reviewers a great picture into what you're hoping to accomplish through hosting a scholar in residence. So So we already did talk about most of these criteria throughout the presentation, but I want to make sure that we are able to get to any questions. So feel free to take a look at our application guidelines and also past webinars to get a feel for these review criteria in action. Okay. And then, Tamin, I'm going to hand it back to you to talk through the review process and timeline.
Great. Thanks, Kaylee. So as we've mentioned, the deadline is October 15th, and we do offer proposal review. So one thing that we say, even though the deadline for proposal review is October 1st, we definitely encourage you to submit that earlier to us. So that gives Kaylee, myself, and the rest of the SIR team more of an opportunity to review your proposal and provide any feedback before the October 15th deadline. So even though the draft deadline is October 1st, the earlier the better. After the deadline on October 15th, we conduct a technical review to make sure that all the components are included in your application. We might be in touch if something is missing or if we have any questions. And once we see that the application is complete and good to go, we'll release it to the External Review Committee. In December, the External Review Committee will meet, they will decide which SIR applications to fund, and from there we'll send out some notifications. So we'll be in touch with the institutions that have been selected, we'll be in touch with the Fulbright Commissions overseas and the embassies if recruitment is needed, and ECA and FFSB, the Foreign Fulbright Scholarship Board, will review the recommended proposals and will confirm with the institutions, the funding, and the commitments. This is all happening between January to April. Around April, we will be sending out the confirmations and the grant packets to all the grantees, and then the grantees should be arriving on campus sometime in August, or if it's a spring start date, sometime in January. So right now, we're in the process to get everything ready for the 2018-2019 SIRs, but for 19-20, it's already time to start the application, start thinking about your requirements for that academic year. So moving to some of the application resources, I think Kaylee highlighted everything that's on the SIR program page and the Fulbright Scholar website as well. The application guidelines are a great tool. You can have the application guidelines open while you complete the narrative and the institutional aspect of the proposal, and they do correspond pretty nicely. And then there's a bunch of different webinars, and not just the application walkthrough, but institutionally targeted webinars for certain demographics for the overview of the SIR presentation. So if there's any additional information that you need, we have that posted on the SIR website. The submission of draft proposal deadline is, again, October 1st. And then on the Scholar in Residence page, you can see some institutions and some past SIRs and read some of their stories and see what other institutions have done for their SIR program grant. So if there's any questions, I think now is a great time to type anything into the chat box, but while you do, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the Outreach Lecturing Fund. We like to highlight OLF as part of this webinar as well, because it corresponds nicely to some of the outreach activities that Scholar in Residence grantees are doing, and a lot of SIRs participate in the Outreach Lecturing Fund. So we have about 900 visiting scholars are in the U.S. at any given time, and these scholars can be SIR or research scholars who are housed in campus or organizational labs. They might be conducting research, and the Outreach Lecturing Fund allows them to travel around the U.S. and present to different institutions. It allows institutions to apply as a host for short-term lectures, so it's like a mini SIR, and it's a nice way to get your feet wet if you don't have any experience in hosting a Fulbright Scholar. These OLF activities can range in between 2 to 6 days, so much shorter than an SIR opportunity, but still the same goals and outcomes for these type of events.
Okay, so, sorry, my mouth again. We have been receiving quite a few questions. I'll be gathering those now, and just again to reiterate this, we have hyperlinks to our website. a little bit more information, contact information, so feel free to reach out to us at any time, but I will jump into the questions now. Okay, so it looks like the first one, we have someone attending who is from a small liberal arts institution in a rural area, and they haven't hosted a scholar in residence in the past, but they also have a community college in their city. So asking if they should plan a joint proposal or if they'd just be able to apply on their own. So, David, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this of a joint proposal versus a standalone proposal.
Sure. So it sounds like based on where you're located, the kind of school you are, you clearly would be a priority school from a couple different standpoints. So you certainly could apply on your own. You don't need to necessarily partner with another organization. On the other hand, if you think that you could provide a stronger application, maybe because you don't have as much experience writing a proposal like this and another institution might, then there may be some rationale for you to do a partnership. The one thing that we would say in terms of the partnership, if that's what you want to do, is we look at proximity of schools, because obviously a scholar would be needing to travel between two schools, which can be a little bit of a challenge. Also, where does the scholar live, and is there housing that, in fact, is convenient to both schools? So there's a little more planning that's required when you're doing that, that combined application. But it really sort of depends on you and on your comfort level in terms of writing a proposal, whether you think you can do it on your own or whether you think you would like to partner with another organization or institution, I should say.
Perfect. And again, that scholar should fit into both institutions nicely also, so the needs of both of those institutions. So kind of making sure that it's prevalent throughout the whole application. We had a question about if you're able to access this presentation later, and yes, this will be uploaded to our website. All of the registrants will receive a message when it has been uploaded so that you can take a look then. And then another question is about how a nonprofit or a non-institutional entity, if they can serve as a host, or how can they be involved? I can answer to the involvement part, and then I might pitch it back to David in a second. But as for the involvement, so if you'll remember that letters of support section, if there is an institution in your area that you know is applying or that you think might be a great host and you talk to them about applying, then you could express your support for that potential scholar in your area by providing a letter of support. And then you could also be sure to be working with that scholar once they arrive and really maximizing on the time and the impact on the scholar's time on campus and in the community. And then, David, did you want to talk about if it would be eligible as a host, a nonprofit?
Yes, technically you would not be eligible because the eligibility is specifically open only to accredited U.S. colleges and universities. But as Kaylee said, you could certainly work with an accredited college or university in your area, encourage them to apply. You could certainly be involved with them in terms of community organization that could benefit from the scholar being in the community. And when Tamara was talking about the outreach lecturing fund, another area where, in fact, you could be partnering with a campus to host a scholar through OLF as another way to get engaged with a scholar and have them, engage with you and have this mutual benefit that we talk about through what the scholar gains from you and what the scholar provides to you. So there's certainly ways to get engaged, although you're not technically eligible to apply on your own.
Great, thank you. And then you'll be, I think, fielding another one in a moment. So it looks like we've received a few questions about budget. So someone has asked if the amount received via the Fulbright Scholar in Residence grant would be affected by a salary supplement or by that in-kind support. And then other people were asking how that grant amount is determined. So if either David or Tamin could talk about that.
Sure, Sam, Tamin, you want to take that?
Sure. So the grant is dependent on how long the scholar will be at your institution and what type of location the institution is in, whether it's a low-cost of living institution or high-cost or super high-cost. So that is not going to, that's not going to be affected by the amount of salary or in-kind support that, that is given by your institution. One thing that I would add, if you're looking to recruit, if you're offering more of a salary supplement or in-kind, that increases the likelihood of finding a scholar from both of the both of the countries where we're sending out recruitment requests. But it doesn't affect the stipend that will come from Fulbright.
Great, thanks. And to answer your question about where you'd be entering that information, you'll be just putting that preliminary, the numbers in that one of those first sections of the application, and then in part of your narrative proposal, one of those sections outlined in the application asks about financial support. So you can just elaborate on it there if you are able to offer financial support. Okay. Someone has asked if it's possible to apply for a full academic year and host two scholars, one in each semester. David, handing this one over to you.
Okay. So we've on an occasion had a school say to us we'd like to do two scholars, one semester, one the second semester. That's conceivable. You would want to show us how you've thought through the process and how you in fact have tied the two semester activities together so that they're somehow related to your overall plan. I guess a parallel question or similar question is some of the people have asked us if they could have more than one scholar at a time, and that's not doable, but having the scholars consecutively is doable. But as I said, you'd want to demonstrate, you know, how those two pieces fit together.
And just saying it again, that really all pieces of the application should serve that larger goal of your program proposal there. Okay, I'm just checking for any additional questions that have come in. Okay, so it looks like we have, there was one more question actually about discipline. So just preference for certain fields of study or if all fields of study can participate through the program. David, did you
want to
take this one also?
Sure. So the program's open to virtually any subject or any discipline. The main point would be, though, that you need to demonstrate in your proposal what the value added is of the scholar coming to campus in terms of a comparative or international perspective being brought to the teaching activities based on what your scholar has to offer. If you look at what we've done typically over the years, I'd say the majority of proposals have been in humanities and social sciences. But having said that, we've seen all sorts of other fields, whether it's whether it's performing arts, whether it's life sciences, whether it's applied sciences, you've name it. We've seen a whole range of fields. We've seen nursing, we've seen healthcare issues, we've seen lots and lots of different kinds of subjects and disciplines. Again, as long as what the scholars will be doing is bringing this comparative or international perspective to the classroom. You know, one of the areas that is sometimes a bit surprising is the area of hard sciences, where I guess the initial reaction would be, how do you bring someone to teach chemistry? Isn't that the same worldwide? And it turns out that, in fact, it's not. And we've had people come in and, in fact, teach hard sciences, yet demonstrate with that scholar coming in that they're bringing a different teaching methodology
or they've got a different way of interacting with students, or the approach might be different. So they demonstrated successfully that, in fact, almost any subject can be presented with that comparative or international perspective.
Okay. And I think with that, we've gotten through our questions here, so it's perfect timing. If anyone does have questions, really use the Tamin and myself and our team over at IIE. We're happy to help out. You can also reach David, and then we are also accessible via many forms of social media. And then I will also say from our website, if you're looking at that Scholar in Residence main homepage, there's a number listed there, and that will come to my desk directly, so you can talk to me anytime you need to. And I think that about wraps it up, but David, did you have any last words that you wanted to mention?
No, I hope that this has interested you, has left you enthusiastic with the possibilities. We talk to campuses all the time, and it's exciting when they tell us that they actually find the opportunity to put a proposal together like this as a way of really being creative and talking about your institution and really showing us, you know, what you've got to offer and why you're a good candidate for SIR. And take this as an opportunity to sort of show off your campus and tell us the good things you're doing and why you think this would be able to make you even a stronger campus.
All right, great. And Tamin, did you have anything you wanted to add?
I think you covered everything. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. And, yes, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to the SIR email address, and Kelly and myself will get back to you as soon as we can, because we want to be able to help you and support you as you begin your application throughout the summer.
All right. Well, thank you so much to everyone for joining us today and for all of your wonderful questions. I hope you all have a nice rest of your afternoon. Thanks again.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thanks.